Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the end of a Supreme Court term and the beginning of a new era on the Supreme Court. And Richard, we are recording this just a few hours after the Supreme Court finished off its session for this year. And we have to start with the big news, which is it came out shortly after the final opinions were handed down that Justice Anthony Kennedy is retiring, which means President Trump gets to pick a new Supreme Court justice before the midterm elections. Mitch McConnell's already said that the vote will happen in the fall. So let's just start with your initial reaction to Justice Kennedy's decision and your thoughts about what comes next.
Well, I think the reason why he decided to resign is that he is still, notwithstanding his deviation from sort of Republican orthodoxy on a large number of issues, he is still somebody who on balance is more conservative than liberal, which is shown by the number of 5-4 majorities this last term, including the Janus case, which came down this same day, on which he has sided with the conservative majority. And he understands, as does everybody else, that if you put this thing off until the November election, the Democrats, if they get a majority, will do unto the Republicans what the Republicans did unto the Democrats when this same question came up some time ago. So to me, it is absolutely clear that I think he wants to give Trump a free hand to move quicker. Now, the other reason I think he wants to give him a free hand is that whatever one thinks about the erratic nature of Donald Trump when it comes to dealing with such things as immigration or with the trade wars with China and the EU, there is nobody on the conservative side of the ledger who has the slightest doubt or quarrel with any of the appointments whom he has made to the various circuit courts, which are obviously the feeders for the Supreme Court. I think the sort of consensus view is that the list of reports varies somewhere between simply superb and absolutely excellent. There's probably nobody who's made it through who has drawn any serious criticism. And there are very many people of all kinds who are regarded as extremely highly amongst the new crop that has come on. And so if you think that the president is going to do a Gorsuch-like number the second time round and look at lists similar to the ones that he looked at earlier on, and you're a Republican, you're not going to have the heart and the mouth feeling that you might have had with Trump when it deals with other issues. And I have to say this is a real reversal of expectations because many people, originalists in particular, wrote letters, one of which I signed, I might add, wondering about Mr. Trump, whether he could ever be counted on to keep his word, given the fact that he's so erratic and everything else. Well, those records are doubts have long been resolved in favor of the president. And so I think, in effect, he's going to move it very hard. And my guess is, since we no longer have worries about cloture, McConnell, who's a superb craftsman, will essentially be able to sort of run this thing and probably get it through. It's going to be striking because I don't think that the next person who comes through is going to have some of Kennedy's intellectual, shall I say, proclivities to the left. They're going to be weaker on gay rights. I thought that Obergefell was wrong, although God knows I'm supportive of gay rights in many, many other kinds of areas. So I don't think that you're going to start to see that. Some people are going to say it may be the end of Roe v. Wade. My view is it's not going to happen. That's a decision that would be seismic in its consequences. And the Republicans, I think, are quite happy with the current equilibrium in which it turns out that there's a lot of pressure on collateral issues, but there's no effort to overturn the basic decision. So there's going to be a huge amount of name calling, a lot of abuse. Democrats are going to gnash their heads. It's going to be a busy summer, but it's not going to be a repetition of Robert Bork. It's not even going to be a repetition of what happened with Clarence Thomas when he was nominated in 1991. I think the Republicans will keep their act together on this one.
So we already know roughly what the menu looks like for potential picks from the president because we have this list that goes back to the campaign of potential appointments he could make to the Supreme Court. This is assuming, of course, that he doesn't go off the board and pick somebody who's not on that list. But from that roster, Richard, anyone in particular that you are strongly favorable towards or any in particular that you would be a little bit more hesitant about getting the nod?
Well, I mean, I don't know everybody on this particular list, and so I'm not going to sit there and say anything negative. There are several people on this list who are good friends, who are former students and so forth, about whom I have the highest regard. I mean, so the question then is, what is it going to start to move him? And I'll just give a couple of general points, I think, which are pretty obvious but nonetheless important. One is, I don't think that he is going to feel an overwhelming compulsion to appoint the woman to this particular open seat, given the fact that the next person who's likely to retire is going to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at which point those pressures would be much larger. Secondly, I don't think he's likely to pick anybody who has not had a fairly substantial term of service sitting on the federal circuits as opposed to the state courts. One of the things about the whole situation that leads me to believe that is, when Justice Souter was appointed to the First Circuit, virtually the next day he was then nominated and appointed to the Supreme Court, and the Republicans had never seen him in action. So I think what's going to happen is, it's going to be somebody who's been around for 8 or 10 years on one of the federal circuits. I think there's a built-in preference in many cases for people coming out of the D.C. Circuit. So on the people on that list, I think one of them, who is certainly going to get a very close look, is Brett Kavanaugh, who's on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Another favorite of mine, I think he's an exceptionally able judge, is Raymond Kethledge, who sits on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal, and I think that he is probably going to get a look. There's going to be this question as to whether or not the kinds of people you appoint are going to provoke Democratic opposition or just outright Democratic rebellion. Gorsuch was a kind of a cerebral guy. There was nothing about his record which made him look one-tenth as confrontational as somebody like Nino Scalia, and one saw the result. So it's not going to be anybody else. I mean, with a certain degree of sadness, I note that my good friend, I don't think Bill Pryor is on this particular list, but it's pretty clear. Oh, he is on the list, but it's not going to happen. I think he understands perfectly well that that just cannot be the case under circumstances like this. In fact, he said so publicly when he was at NYU last October. Too controversial in these times, even though he's a wonderfully able judge. I don't think it will be Diane Sykes, because I think that Trump does not like her former husband, Charlie Sykes. And in this world, it's crazy. I don't think it's likely to be any of the very strong and able new judges who've been appointed. That would be Amal Thapar, sitting in the Sixth Circuit, David Strauss sitting in the Eighth Circuit, Amy Comey Barrett sitting in the Seventh Circuit, Allison Ives sitting in the Tenth Circuit, because they're just too new, and I think that they're going to start to be seasoned. So my guess is it's going to probably be one of the names that I've mentioned, but who knows? I mean, the president is mercurial. The question is, who's he going to go look to? And if he's going to go back to McGahn, is he going to go back to Leonard Leo or the Federalist Society? My guess is you will get somebody very much in the Gorsuch mold.
Richard, there's one name that stands out on the list just because it's so much different than the other ones that are on there, and that's Mike Lee, the senator from Utah. Does have a legal background, but I'm curious, you know, when President Obama was in office, he would occasionally wax about the importance of having somebody on the Supreme Court with a political background. I wonder to what extent you think that's a relevant consideration, and to what extent somebody like Mike Lee could be a helpful addition to the court.
Well, I think it used to be a relevant consideration, but I think lately what's happened is we've just gone to the well of appellate court judges, and my guess is there we will sit. Somebody like Lee, obviously, is a serious constitutional thinker, but these particular days, given the sort of huge amount of technical stuff that comes before the Supreme Court, much of it's extraordinarily important, I think the odds of appointing a former senator in the mode of Hugo Black are much lower than they were before. And somebody like Lee, I mean, is known mainly for his fairly strong originalist constitutional views, from which I part company on time to time, but not always by any means. And I think that he, again, might fall into the category of people who are a little bit too controversial, because what you have to worry about when you're running a 51-person majority, you may be able to pick up one or two Democrats, Heidi Heitkamp and so forth. But I do think, in effect, that if you start losing even a single Republican and it starts taking place somewhere in the process, you could lose the closure. And I think Lee is a high risk. On the plus side, he is a member of the Senate and liked, I'm sure, by many people. But on the downside, I think he's a little bit unknown. And I think the uncertainty in this particular case is going going to really hurt. It's the same point I'm making about him that I make about the recent appointees to the Supreme, or rather to the Federal Circuit Courts. If they're there only for a year or for less and they don't have a track record, I don't think that those people are going to be well enough known and established to get strong enough support from the people on their side. And the uncertainty, therefore, will play into the hands of the Democrats, which I think the Republicans have to avoid.
You hinted a little bit earlier at the progressive sort of nightmare scenarios that you don't think will come to fruition, movement on Roe v. Wade, for instance. But take the flip side of that. Give us a sense of what could be on the table in a positive sense that you might get from a new appointment in the Gorsuch mold that you wouldn't with Justice Kennedy.
Well, you're asking a very hard question. I mean, if you had asked me this question a couple of months ago, I would have said, well, there's always the Janus case, which is coming up, and it will clearly change if it comes out the way I expect it will, 5-4. The entire political dynamic with respect to public unions, not as disastrous as many Democrats think or as helpful as many Republicans hope, but I still think it would be a major change. If I was starting to sort of look on the particular list of things that I think that Republicans want to do, in terms of changing the basic landscape, I don't think of anything that I would regard as a sort of a high priority on their scale, except perhaps one now that I think about it, which would be, I think that the Republicans, judging from the precinct rounds, are deeply suspicious of the effort to try and redistrict through judicial means. To some extent, they are sympathetic with the fact that a lot of these legislatures now are in Republican hands and they're Republicans. That's not a principled argument, but it's always lying there in the background. Remember, many states now are, in fact, heavily Republican. I think that makes a difference. But there's also, I think, the genuine worry is once you start to invalidate plans and yet you're not prepared to put your own plans into place, what you do is you create this no man's land in which you strike down plan after plan that's put together by a state legislature, and then you tell them to do it over again. And after a while, when nothing's done, you have to figure out what kind of districts you're going to have when you run the next kind of election. That was very much on the mind of the Supreme Court in the recent Texas case that came down, where in the end they said if there's an interim plan that seemed to work, you can't strike that down and start all over again. Just take a rest on this stuff. Their willingness to punt on standing grounds, which I regarded as artificial at best, in the situation that took place in Gill in Wisconsin, Gill against Whitford, is, I think, another sign in that direction. So I think that what is likely to happen is not a major change, but I think that the sort of the uniform push in an effort to try and get some more careful political economy to figure out whether or not these districts are loaded or not is going to run into trouble. And it's a kind of a split verdict. I think most of the measures of partisan behavior showing that a very small percentage of a majority gets you a very large vote in the Senate, that there are a lot of wasted votes in Democratic districts and a lot of very heavily used votes in Republican districts are, in fact, pretty valid criticisms. I don't think that there's been any good statistical refutation of the stuff that has gone on. But by the same token, I also think that it's extremely difficult to know what kind of remedy you have unless the court is prepared to say, look, this is not a sovereign function to redistrict states. We're going to hire somebody with a computer, ask them to draw compact districts starting from some arbitrary point within the state, everything else be damned, but they're not willing to do it. And so long as you've got a situation in which a court is willing to strike down plans but not to put them in place, the inability to do the second is going to really compromise their abilities to do the first. So I think that's one issue which is likely to stay that way. If you had asked me before this time what would have happened in these cases, I would have thought that given the power of the case that the attackers of the Wisconsin redistricting plan had a better even chance of winning. Now I think it's going to be sharply less than that. One other area I would like to see some movement, the strengthening of property rights. Justice Kennedy, I thought, was really quite weak on many of those issues. His opinion in Muir, one of the cases from Wisconsin, again, was a balancing case and had so many ifs, ands, and buts in it that after the particular decision, you had no idea of what it was going to do for any other case having to do with land use regulation. The decision in dissent that Justice, or the opinion in dissent that Justice, the Chief Justice Roberts wrote, was a little bit better, but was also, I thought, much too accommodating to what I regard as the most dangerous of these tests, the Penn Central test, which says that if we call something a regulation, it only gets low rational based rational basis scrutiny, if we call it a taking, it gets per se scrutiny, and then the line between these two things becomes utterly obscure. I would like to see that change, but, you know, in the Reagan years, I thought there was some genuine momentum on the property rights issue. Now, I don't even see any strong momentum for it on the Republican side. All the cases that have vindicated property rights on individual circumstances have done so on very narrow grounds. And cases like Muir, which was a Kennedy confection, went very far in the other direction and made Penn Central the world's most indefensible case, even more persuasive and more powerful than it ever was. So what I think is really going to happen is you're going to see one liberal initiative after another being batted down, which will please the conservatives and frustrate the liberals. And this will lead to an immense amount of political disputation, because there's no question that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is becoming ever more powerful. Witness the recent election in New York State, where a 20-year-old Latina woman upsets an established Republican Democratic guy. It shows you what the anger is, and the new folks who are coming in will not cotton well to sort of the old man establishment that they perceive on the Republican Supreme Court. So I think that is, it's likely that the Republicans will get somebody through. And if they do, I think it will intensify the political differences.
Speaking of anger on the left, the last question that I'll put to you today, the diagnosis that we're seeing from progressives already, just in the few hours since Justice Kennedy has made this announcement, is that the headwaters of all of this, the original sin that is informing the Republican takeover of the court, was Mitch McConnell's decision to block President Obama from getting Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court when Justice Scalia died. So probably worth revisiting that here on the merits, as I'm sure we're going to be hearing this argument again and again over the next few months. Do you, Richard, thinking back on what McConnell did, do you regard that as some fundamental violation of political norms?
No, I don't. I regard it as a case of intense political hard pull. And when the tables are returned, all of a sudden it will be the Democrats who are saying having eight on the Supreme Court is perfectly okay if the ninth guy is somebody whom we truly hate. So I don't think it has that characteristic at all. It was an extremely gutty move. Obama, I thought, played his cards exactly correctly. What he did is he picked a Democrat who's a little bit older than some of the others. So you're not buying 20 years out of somebody like Merrick Garland. You're buying 10 or 15. I think if you put him on the ideological scale, he was a little bit further to the right than even Stephen Breyer, who's generally thought to be the most right wing of the four Democrats. It goes Breyer, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, and he would be somewhat closer. But there's a huge gap between him and John Roberts on the other side. And I think the wisdom or the distaste of the decision is perfectly clear. Take every one of the major 5-4 decisions that have come down, including the one on immigration and the one that came down on public unions today and the one that came back on the abortion clinics the other day. In each and every one of those cases, I would think the odds are 95% or more that a Merrick Garland, if a justice, would have voted with the Democrat. And so essentially what the game that McConnell played is he said, I'm not interested in the 90% of the cases where these decisions are 7-2 and 8-1. Those tend to be relatively unimportant decisions, and I don't care who's there. I'm interested in the 5-10 cases every year in which it turns out that the selection of the ninth Supreme Court justice is going to tip things one way or another. So he thought the stakes were enormous. I think Obama thought exactly the same thing. I think the Democrats thought the same thing. And so what happened is he won that gamble. Did he steal a seat? Well, he played a very gutsy game, but essentially vice and consent of the Senate is not subject to a good faith requirement. There's no obligation to give a hearing. So politically, there may be a lot of resentment, but legally, there was absolutely nothing that anybody could do about it. And the Democrats understood that as well as the Republicans. So they are now waiting and wait, and they will do exactly the same thing on the other side. I think it's fair to say that the notion of comedy, which one thought existed, doesn't exist anymore. I noticed that when Justice Kennedy was confirmed, it was 97-0. And this is just after the Bork hearing, if you recall. And that was for that seat, indeed. But since that time, it's never been that way. And my guess is that if you're going in to any nomination, you essentially are going to assume that you're going to have a uniform phalanx on the opposite side of the particular case.
All right. Give us plenty to talk about in the next few months. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's @RichardAEpstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting defining ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.